Hello and welcome to our Road to Glasgow podcast. I'm Stephen Scheel. I'm your host for today. Today we've got a fantastic conversation lined up. We have very knowledgeable contributors, experts in their fields, and we're going to be talking about reusing oil and gas infrastructure with respect to carbon capture, usage and storage. Joining us today, we have Murray Anderson and Neil Robertson from Crondall Energy. Hi, guys.
Good afternoon.
And Luca Corradi, my colleague from OGTC. Luca, are you well?
Hello.
Good. So we will be discussing all things related to hydrogen, CCUS, and repurposing oil and gas infrastructure. And I'm looking forward to this discussion because it's got quite a lot to unpack. But before we kind of dive straight in, I'm just going to ask Murray and Neil just to kind of give a little bit of an introduction as to why this particular topic is close to their hearts and the perspective that they're bringing to it. So, Neil, can we start with you, and I'll then bring Murray into that.
Yeah, certainly. Well, I guess Crondall Energy is in two parts. We've got a subsea part and a floating production part. We're on the subsea side. And I guess one of our key activities has always been pipeline engineering and design. And so recently we've been getting involved in carbon capture, and that's got us involved in thinking about CO2 pipelines. And clearly as part of that, the reuse of infrastructure is one of the topics that we've been thinking about.
Excellent. And Murray, what's your perspective?
Yeah, well, just to add to what Neil said there, we are looking quite hard at the moment at the whole energy transition picture, and carbon capture and storage is clearly quite a key part of that. We kind of recognise that in order to make full use of the engineering skills that we have, as the industry matures and moves forwards, particularly in the North Sea, we do need to look to the energy transition to keep our young engineers excited and interested in what we're doing. So carbon capture and storage, and in particular the subsea aspects of it, is a very exciting area for us to be involved with. So it's really it's one of the up and coming challenging areas that we think we need to be involved with.
That's great. And Luca, I'm going to ask you just to give a little bit of perspective as well, a little bit of context as to why carbon capture and storage is so fundamentally important in the fight against climate change. So why do we need to do this in the first place?
Carbon capture and hydrogen are both key elements for the UK to achieve the net zero target by 2050. But also at global level, and they're part of the Committee on Climate Change six carbon budget or any scenarios. And I think there isn't any scenario in the world that doesn't include an element of carbon capture in order to achieve net zero. The current rate of emissions in the atmosphere are telling us we'd most likely overshoot the carbon budget, which is how much CO2 we can still put in the atmosphere. And although we need to do everything possible to abate those emissions, there will still be a number of that in the atmosphere. So there will be at some point even the need to do some direct air capture and remove it from the atmosphere. But that, even before that, it's important that industry or human activities that still emit, and there will still always be some emit, are decarbonized. And particularly for the UK, a key element of industrial decarbonization has to do with carbon capture. We have five clusters in the UK, one in Scotland, and the Grangemouth, Teesside, so the Wales, and a couple of others. And they all have an element of decarbonize through hydrogen to replace gas as a source of power, and carbon capture and storage. And when it comes to storage, it is the North Sea. It is the North Sea, which is the destination and offers a basin with what is called storage locations, which are mainly depleted gas reservoir or saline aquifers that can take that CO2. I think the important bit for us here is also, well, if that is the solution and that is part of the solution, what role does the current oil and gas industry and its supply chain play into that? Because the advantage is that the skills the system, the infrastructure, the knowledge of the oil and gas industry can play a pivotal part to make that happen. And that brings us to today, right? So the infrastructure element, how much of that infrastructure can actually be reused for CCS or for hydrogen? And that's a very interesting topic. But I think maybe Mari and Neil, one point to start would be, let's talk about CO2 transport. You know, when we decarbonize industry, so we capture the CO2 somewhere, we transport somewhere else. And in your case, it's mainly on the subsea element. We need to transport this CO2 to the storage location, which is under the seabed. What are the challenges there? You know, is that standard and normal? Because people are obviously concerned about leaks, but it's more than that, right? So there are technical challenges.
Well, I guess one way to approach it is to think about what's the same and what's different. So in terms of what's the same, if you look at a sketch of a carbon capture system, it kind of looks quite similar. You've got an onshore plant. It looks like the reverse of an oil field. You've got an onshore plant, you've got a pipeline, and then you've got some sort of platform or subsea development, and then subsea wells injecting the CO2 into a reservoir. So it feels quite familiar. A lot of the systems are similar: pipelines, platforms, wells, manifolds, these sorts of things. So that aspect seems similar. It's about containment, retaining pressure, all these elements, so that a lot of the skills that we use in the oil and gas industry are directly transferable. In terms of differences, it's obviously going in the reverse direction, so that's one thing that's different, and we'll come on to some of the implications of that in a minute or later. It's a different fluid, obviously, and it behaves completely differently. You know, I think we're all familiar with oil and gas as being a major accident hazard if it releases and ignites. CO2 doesn't ignite. It's not flammable. However, if you do get a massive evacuation of dense phase CO2, it is very dangerous. It basically eliminates all the oxygen from the area. It can asphyxiate people and animals. So it does have a major accident hazard.
And it's worth saying at that point, Neil, that CO2 is particularly dangerous because in the absence of any odorization of the gas, so you can't smell it, it is an odorless gas, it's colorless, you can't see it, and it's heavier than air. So putting it up a stack isn't really going to help. It does sink back down again.
So some of the other differences, I suppose, it's a solvent. So as it flows through the system, it tends to carry out all sorts of dirt and grease out of valves and other components. So that's a challenge in terms of leaks and in terms of keeping mechanical equipment working. It also seeps into seals, elastomeric seals, and so you can get explosive decompression, which is not unknown in the oil industry either. I guess in terms of operability, Murray, there's quite a few challenges as well in terms of how you've got to control impurities that input into the quality of the CO2 that gets put into the system, and how the phase changes with different impurities, which can be a big challenge as well. Murray knows more about that than I do.
Yeah, I think the biggest single difference, I guess, my background is all in the sort of flow assurance side of things, so I probably would say this, but the biggest single difference I see in the carbon capture and storage industry is the differences in the phase behavior and the behavior of the CO2 in its different phases as it's transported. It's very, very challenging because with a depleted gas reservoir, you can be injecting into pressures of, well, I guess as low as 4 or 5 bar in some cases for a relatively shallow depleted gas reservoir. Under those conditions, the CO2 will be in gas phase in the well, and it isn't necessarily the most efficient way of transporting it in the pipeline system at low pressure in gas phase. CO2 has a critical pressure of about 74 bar, which is a very awkward point for pipeline transportation because it needs to be above 74 bar to stay in the sort of liquid dense phase and to transport it in single phase at any temperature subsea. You would ideally want to be transporting it at either at above, significantly above 74 bar, or at significantly below 74 bar. And if you think about the pressure loss in a pipeline system being, let's say, half a bar to one bar per kilometre, and if you're operating, let's say, 50 or 100 kilometres offshore, so you need something like 50 to 100 bar of pressure drop across the pipeline, it's very easy to see that that you don't have much room to operate in, either in the gas phase, where all the pressures are low, or in the dense phase, unless your pipeline systems are operated at really quite high pressures. So there are lots of challenges with the fluid itself, not least because of its harmful properties if it is released, but because of its phase behaviour within the pipeline systems.
So I've got a couple of questions just to jump in there, because this is, I mean, we've got quite technical very quickly, and I think this is pretty good, actually. So it sounds like, from what you're telling me, in the pressure rating side of things, that this could potentially be quite a high energy activity to actually transport the CO2 in the pipeline in order to get it right. Am I right in thinking that, or have I picked you up wrong?
No, I think potentially it is. I think initially in a depleted gas reservoir, you can operate at low pressures. At low pressures, you need quite large volumes, so you need quite large pipelines. So the challenge there is shifting the volume of gas at low pressure. You don't need too much energy to do that. It starts becoming a lot more energy intensive if you do move into into the dense phase, because primarily for a lot of the emitters, the onshore emitters where you're collecting the gas, you'll be collecting it in a gas phase. You'll then have to change that phase. You'll have to go from gas phase into a liquid phase or a dense phase. So that involves compression and potentially cooling. You then have to transport it at that dense phase, and then you have to get it into the reservoir, potentially with quite big pressure drops. And there can be quite a lot of energy expenditure associated with that, just the transitions from gas to dense to potentially back into gas phase again. I should say that there are two, types of reservoir that potentially we can inject into. There are the depleted gas reservoirs, which may be at low pressure, and those the pressures in those reservoirs will obviously build up over time. So eventually the reservoir does move into a dense phase pressure regime once the pressures are significantly above 74 bar. There are challenges associated with that. But we can also inject into aquifers, where you're injecting into a water-filled reservoir. And that brings a whole additional set of challenges, even though the pressures are higher. So in some ways, it's easier to manage the pressures. It becomes more difficult to manage issues like hydrate formation, where you mix water with the CO2. You've got the potential to mix water with the CO2 and form solid components that you would really rather weren't in the system. So there are lots of challenges, but we have done a bit of work on looking at potentially how much. I think the term used is embedded carbon, but it's more to do with the carbon generated in the transportation and storage of CO2. So in order to get the CO2 into the reservoir, you have to run compressors, you have to run equipment and generate more carbon in that process. And what we've found is that operationally, round about 1-2% of the injected gas is expended on compressing and delivering it to the system. So the numbers are not unmanageably high, but they do have to be taken into account.
And I guess, Mari, this assumes that the compressor are powered with the gas or fossil fuel, as opposed to electrification of that, even if it's only 1%.
That's absolutely right. If the compressors are electrified, if you're looking for your power sources from renewable energy, then that amount of operational carbon comes down. So it can be reduced quite significantly. But I think we are potentially some way from doing that at the moment. Okay. I think the the initial CCUS projects will more than likely be using conventional oil, more conventional oil and gas type technologies, particularly offshore. It may be that electrification is the ultimate goal.
So if I summarize what you said before, I think there are two options here to transport that CO2 through pipelines. You know, either is in a gas state or in gas phase, which is a large volume. You need a big pipeline and low energy because you don't need to compress it too much and is low pressure, therefore. Or in liquid, in which in case you need a lot of power to compress it and the lower volume of the pipe. Is that correct? And if so, what is the direction that the various projects you might have been involved or you're aware of in the UK, they're taking? Are they planning to transport that in liquid phase or in gas phase? Because you mentioned, of course, you know, when it's captured in gas state from a chimney or the stack of a factory. But some of the projects that have pipe transportation to the storage location, like the Grange Mouth to St. Fergus, for example, in Scotland. Some others, like Norway, you know, the Northern Light are instead transporting them by ship. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if they're transporting by ship in a liquid state or a gaseous state.
It'll be liquefied in, if it's for ship transport, liquefied and stored at round about 12 bar, I think, is the pressure. So the ship transportation involves cooling and storing at low temperatures in order to make that practical. Clearly, that's not an option that we have for pipeline transportation subsea. So if it's being transported in liquid or dense phase, or supercritical phase, it has to be done through high pressure. Whether it's transported in gas phase or what we call dense phase really depends on the what you're injecting into. And if you are injecting into a low pressure depleted gas reservoir, then the chances are you'll want to transport initially in gas phase with low energy requirements, minimal or avoiding phase changes wherever possible, and keeping the system as simple as possible. Once the pressure starts to build up in the subsurface in the reservoir, you necessarily have to change at some point to dense phase transportation. CO2, there's a technical point about how tight the phase envelope is. It doesn't behave like multi-component oil and gas mixtures. It's generally the specifications for CO2 transportation will have round about 95% pure CO2, and it behaves much more like a single component rather than a mixture of lots of different components. That means that it changes phase very rapidly, and that makes it very difficult to run in multi-phase. So that's why we avoid multi-phase transportation, and we would want to try and avoid phase transitions in the system as much as possible, because this very tight phase envelope gives rise to all sorts of difficulties in transportation if you have a phase change in the system. That knocks on to operability and lots of questions about whether the system and the wells in particular remain stable if you have a dense phase pipeline and a gas phase subsurface.
But and I guess, Murray, it also raises questions about if you do start in gas phase and have to transition to dense phase later, how and when that transition happens, because it's not necessarily an easy thing to do. You're going to need less pipelines, more pressure. If you've got an existing infrastructure, it's not going to be easily necessary to make that switch.
So is there an argument to build new fit for purpose specific infrastructure to do this? I mean when you come down to it, we're trying to use existing infrastructure, but should we also be considering building new infrastructure?
I think it'll all come down to a case by case assessment, really. I think there is a case for reuse, but it's quite a difficult argument, really. I mean, I think clearly you can save a lot of money if you can use existing infrastructure, but then that infrastructure wasn't designed for CO2 and it may not be suitable for it. and it may not be in a good enough condition. So there's a lot of work has to go into inspecting the existing line and making sure that it's fit for purpose. And of course, it's quite a big ask, really, because we're looking for these pipelines to operate with CO2 for, say, 30 years or something. And it may already have had a 30-year life as an oil and gas pipeline, perhaps designed with a design life of 30 years. So it's not like a life extension. The process we use to evaluate it is very similar to life extension work. But instead of trying to get an extra 5 or 10 years out of it, you're trying to get double the original design life. So that's quite a big ask from the start, but it's not undoable. And it all depends really on what sort of condition the pipeline is in, which requires a lot of inspection and analysis to make that sure. But it also depends what sort of pipeline that was used for. Now, the dense phase, as Murray's described, the operating pressure is quite high. So if the pipeline design pressure is quite close to that operating pressure, it doesn't give you much headroom for operations. So there are all these sort of things that have got to come into it. But you're right, there is, you know, when it comes down to it, I guess one of the concerns with if you use a reuse pipeline and you're trying to get an extra 30 years out of it, that's fine. But, you know, all these oil and gas pipelines that were designed for 30 years, when it came to 30 years, we all wanted them to work an extra 10 or 12 years or 10 or 20 years. And the same, I'm sure, will happen with these CO2 pipelines. When they get to the end of their life, they're going to want to extend them again. So I think it is quite a difficult ask.
Yeah, and the other thing that struck me, I mean, Luca mentioned the Northern Lights project with CO2 being transported by ship. Most of the projects that we seem to have here in the UK are kind of like closed loop systems where you have, you know, a specific site for capture and you have a specific methodology for transportation to the reservoir. And it's all kind of like joined up because of its existing infrastructure that we've got. But one of the arguments for CCS in the North Sea is the ability to actually import CO2 from other parts of Europe, for example, because we have vast storage capacity. And that could be an economic model. But because we're doing that, it sounds like there's lots of technical challenges and maybe cost challenges behind the importation of CO2. Am I just jumping to a conclusion or is there something behind that?
Well, if I can say maybe a couple of things there is this is all a moving part system in a way, right? So clearly, based on studies, the UK and Scotland in particular has a big potential for a storage location and gas or oil and gas reservoir, but also in aquifer. And that theoretically can accommodate many decades of the whole European carbon CO2 emissions, if we can collect all of that. So in theory, there's a demand and there's a supply. That's also true if you ask in Norway. They're also thinking and building a model to which they can import CO2 from Netherlands or Denmark or other continental Europe countries, which have the opposite problem. They produce CO2 and they don't have a storage location for it. You know? So is there a market out there? Potentially, you know, different countries are looking at a potential international market. There are, of course, some international challenges in transporting CO2 across boundaries and especially in the regulation front. But all that is, as I said, is an evolving situation. And I think what comes to mind in that case is the flexibility element, you know, because you're right, a closed loop system is easier to design because it's starting one way and finishing the other way. What Neil were referring before is, I think, if you start with a situation in which you have a gas phase, CO2, and then it becomes liquid, then the infrastructure doesn't work. So if you design a system to accommodate the gas, the CO2 coming from a Grangemouth, for example, then that same infrastructure is unlikely to work if you get the CO2 from other places, or it really depends on where it goes in the reservoir. And
I think it's in a way that there's definitely potential market there. I mean, if the continental Europe needs to get rid of CO2 and we have the capability to store it, why wouldn't we make a business out of that? I think there are a couple of things. That the biggest issue probably is that these projects are not going to happen overnight. They're going to take a lot of planning in order to build them. and having visibility of what that demand is essential if you're going to design a system. Because being able, when you design a system to capture, say, 5 million tons a year or something, and then you see an opportunity to capture 15, you can't just very easily reconfigure to do 15. You really have to plan ahead. And this is where the uncertainty comes in, and is in knowing what that market is going to be. But there are advantages. I think the other thing is that the clusters in the UK all have their own industrial capture area and their own transport and storage connected to them. And they're not interconnected at all at the moment. But you can see situations where, if one plant isn't capable of producing of capturing, you would want to continue capturing the CO2 in that cluster and put it somewhere else. So there is the more flexibility you've got in the overall system, the better it must be for meeting climate change targets.
That sounds like almost constructing a sorry, I didn't want to speak over you. That sounds almost like constructing almost like a CO2 CCS grid onshore. Is that what you're suggesting?
I think you could potentially look at an onshore CCUS grid. I think there are big challenges with that because of the risks with transporting CO2, particularly in dense phase, in pipelines. You could also look at it as being a sort of road, rail, or ship transport of CO2 between clusters from one side to the other, and clearly, you may argue that pipelines are safer than road transport in some respects. That there'll be a lot of work to do to understand what the issues might be. It doesn't necessarily need to be a pipeline grid transporting CO2. It could be a network of some other form. It's also interesting to try and understand what the boundaries of the CCUS capture plant and the transport and storage network actually are, because the capture plant may be asked to deliver the carbon dioxide, let's say in dense phase or in gas phase, at a certain spec, or you could relax that spec, and the transport and storage network could take the responsibility for either cleaning up or compressing that gas and getting it into their system. And I guess the more relaxed the entry specification is, the more opportunity you have to bring in other sources, such as ship transport or rail transport, or let's say smaller plants that don't justify the carbon capture infrastructure that you would need to clean up the gas that they capture. So I think it's not clear yet exactly how the capture plant and the transport and storage network, where the boundaries are between those two elements of the system.
Yeah, no, that's a good point, Murray, that a lot comes back to this, the entry spec, and whether you design discrete systems that decide their own entry spec, because of course the wider the entry spec, the more issues there are with operability. The tighter the entry spec, the more expensive it is for emitters to input into the system. But then if the spec is discrete to each cluster, if you like, then there's little scope for transferring CO2 between them. But if you have an industrial strategy to have a standard spec, then it becomes easier to do that. And I don't think in the UK yet we've quite bottomed that out yet.
One of the statements that has been made recently is that government intend to come back to the market with some form of business model to make CCS a reality. Is that something that you can talk to or right now, or can you share anything on that?
I can't really. We know there are initiatives going on. We're not directly involved because we're strictly on the technical side, really. But we know that is happening on another part of the initiative.
Uh-huh. Any sense of the time frame for that? When we might begin to hear what that potential business model could look like?
I don't really have any information on that, but my guess is it would be coming clear over the summer.
Yeah, some way to make it work both for the emitters and for the storage. component. And I think back to what you say before is interesting. We can expect two different or complementary business model from a capturing and then from a transportation and storage, because you want to be able to have an element of flexibility on where the carbon, the CO2 is coming from, instead of this closed loop. Although, you know, the starting point will be closed loop for a period of time, because that will secure the end-to-end from emitter to storage. But in the long run, you can't guarantee that the emitters will stay there, we continue emitting the same way. Just making a simple example, some of the emitters are refineries, and phasing out petrol and diesel car, replacing with electric vehicles, zero emission vehicle, will reduce the demand for refinery and therefore will reduce the production of CO2, which is good for the planet and the atmosphere, of course, but that might challenge the economics of the carbon capture and storage project, which is only designed and modeled around that specific plant. So there is an element there of flexibility required in the system. So you can take the CO2 from somewhere else that needs to store it, and not only from one single point of...
There is, and I think it's quite a fine balance as well, isn't it? You have to continually make sure that all the actors have the right motivations to do the right thing. And I think it's quite a difficult, quite a different balance to achieve.
Yeah, I think there's some interesting numbers in that. I guess I was looking at some of the statistics earlier on today, and the UK emissions number that I've seen from 2019 was something like 435 million tons of CO2 equivalent. Now, if we're aiming for a net zero target in 2050, then my understanding is that will require us to be storing about 176 million tons per year in 2050. So presumably the difference between those two numbers reflects the reduction in CO2 emissions from 2019 to 2050. So the question then is that there must be a sweet spot at which you ultimately want the capacity of the CCUS network to be able to handle how much gas do you actually need it to cope with. It's not going to be as much as 435 million tons per year, but it probably will be a little bit more than 176 million tons per year ultimately. Those are quite big numbers, and I think the target for 2030 is 10 million tons per year. So it's a small fraction of what our current emissions actually are, but it's a start. And I think to get the commercial agreements and the business models in place to be able to ramp up from 10 to say 150 million tons per year, it's critical to do that within the next year or two, I guess.
One of the things I'm very conscious of talking to you about this is that we have an existing infrastructure. As Neil was saying, there's a lot that's similar or familiar about the process of CCS. It's in reverse to what we're doing with extraction of natural gas, for example, and oil. Many of the detractors of CCS would say it's unproven, and obviously there are projects around the world and in the UK now that show that it can be done. But what technologies do we still need to develop, and where are the key pinch points that we need to focus on to make this more economical? Because it sounds like applying existing technologies might just be too expensive, and we're going to have to innovate a little bit.
I think there are technical challenges where there's innovation is essential, and the obvious case from the flow assurance point of view is trying to get gas into very low pressure depleted reservoirs. If we follow the conventional oil and gas production sort of technology approach, we would put our point of control, our chokes, at the wellhead, at the top of the well. And if we do that with CO2 injection system, then we can potentially generate phase changes and very low temperatures in the well itself, which make the well very difficult to operate. So the question then becomes, is that the right place to control the flow, or should we be looking at technologies for downhole chokes, for choking at the bottom of the well where it's nice and warm, so that the so that you don't generate the big Joule Thomson cooling effects that you get with wellhead choking, and that could take us away from some of the need for, or some of the potential need for heating the CO2 before it's injected into the well. There are technologies in the whole well design area, I think, that do need to be considered and developed. I think bulk transportation of CO2, I think the kind of the technologies for liquefaction, for extraction, for purification, and for compression are all there, but they just need to be put together in the right order to deal with the sort of volumes that we're talking about. The numbers are, you know, 176 million tons per year. That's a lot of fluid, but by any standard. So it's scaling some of these things up is going to be a challenge.
I think a couple of other areas that we've been looking at are when you're injecting into an aquifer, you know, unlike the depleted oil and gas, where you would inject at low pressure and build up over time, with the aquifer, it's generally at pressure already, and you can inject an amount of CO2 into it before you need to do anything. But eventually, you approach the fracture pressure of the reservoir, and you have to start taking off brine to keep the pressure down. And I think we didn't appreciate initially, but I think in recent months we've been looking very closely at this: how much brine you would have to take off, and how you get rid of it. And that's potentially a big expense for a CO2 storage development. And I think finding low cost ways to do that will be a big challenge, because at the moment we've had to, you know, brine is obviously very corrosive. You've got to either dilute it or process it in some way, which means taking it back to the platform. If you do that, you probably need to put in a pipeline, because it's so corrosive. That might mean an Inconel clad pipeline. It suddenly becomes very expensive. You might need to have pumps to draw it off, because there's not really much back pressure. Suddenly you're faced with this infrastructure that's actually more expensive than the CO2 injection infrastructure. So I think finding low cost solutions to that will be a big challenge. Another thing that we've come across is, because the flow is in reverse, and I guess in an oil and gas field, when your process facility falls over or trips in some way, or something stops working, the oil well just gets shut in and you defer production for another day generally. In this situation where you're going in the reverse direction, you can't really stop the emitters, the industrial processes, from working. They still need to create CO2 and to capture it and inject it. So there's continual input into the system. And so the system falls over, you know, has a failure or something, you have to be able to accommodate that in the operating philosophy of the system. And one of the disadvantages of operating at dense phase is you can't do a lot of line packing in the pipeline. So we think there's going to be a need to have some sort of temporary storage in order to smooth out these peaks and troughs of the input demand, because you don't want to have fluctuations in the injection rates at the wells. So yeah. I think that's also a challenge, is how to develop low cost storage for the system to allow ease of operability. And that brings us kind of back full circle, in that I guess you'd probably do that in gas phase, because you can pack it and unpack it relatively easily. And that might be an opportunity for the reuse of infrastructure, of existing infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are a few points that come out of that. And I guess the question of right sizing is one of them. I think our traditional way of sizing a gas transmission pipeline is based on the capacity of that line and the volume of gas that you need to shift. That may not be the correct approach for CO2. It may be that you have to size it in order to give yourself some sort of storage or some sort of capacity to allow The swings in emitter production, let's say there are swings in electricity production from a gas-fired power station. So you need to deal with the swings on the input side, and you also need to deal with the potential availability of the wells, so that if you lose a well, you don't have to then shut down or vent one of the onshore emitters. So right sizing the pipeline and the whole philosophy of designing and sizing the CO2 pipeline system isn't necessarily the same as for a gas transmission system. There are other factors that need to be taken into account.
So I guess what I'm hearing is always interesting to talk with engineers, because engineers love the challenges and they look for them in every corner. But you know, I'd like to maybe to give a positive message or a question. You know, so it's not doable or is difficult, but it is doable and we'll do it.
No, I think it's all doable. Yeah. It just requires us to think a little bit differently. So as always, it's a new problem, and you have to think a little bit differently to solve it. But yeah, none of it is unsolvable, I don't believe.
Yeah, I would agree completely with that. I think what is interesting is that there is a slight change in mindset. It's not, as Neil said right at the start, there are a lot of similarities to subsea oil and gas infrastructure design and construction, but there are a lot of differences. And I guess as engineers, we love to find things that are challenging and because they have differences. I haven't seen anything yet that doesn't appear to be manageable in some way, but it's sufficiently different that it needs to be thought through properly. It's not just a case of saying, we'll just run these pipelines in reverse or run these wells, run these wells in reverse. It is a case of thinking the problem through very carefully to come up with a system that can not only transport the volumes of CO2 that are requested, but also do that in an operable and a stable manner.
So that's a great point, because one of the things that frustrate me about this whole subject is how long it seems to take to get an operable solution off the ground. For example, one of the clusters in the UK is here in Scotland, it's the Acorn project. And when are they going live? Is it not around about 2023, 2024, somewhere?
2023, that's the plan.
Yeah, that's right.
But they've been planning that for some time, and the scale of what they're trying to do is it mid-scale or is it large? I think it's probably mid-scale in terms of approach.
Exactly, scalable though, right? So it is a small or mid-size, but with a scalability element to it.
Okay. And we need many more of these. And we need many more of these types of projects. And it sounds like if we're going to achieve the volumes that Murray and Neil have suggested, that we're going to have to do CCS at scale.
It has to be at much bigger scale, but I think the starting point is to get some of these clusters up and running and get some experience, some real operational experience with injecting CO2, because the challenges are always with the things that you don't know about, and we can sit at our desks and think about the sorts of challenges we might be facing and engineer those out as far as it's practical. But when it comes to actually operating a system in practice with all the unforeseen vagaries of that, there will be issues that come out of it that we're not aware of at the moment. So getting that operational experience at a small scale is going to be absolutely vital, and doing that over the next few years, learning from that as quickly as possible and then scaling it up as quickly as it's practical to do, I think is really important.
I think it also comes back to Luca's point that, again, focusing on similarities and differences with the oil industry, you know, if they were producing a product they could sell on the market, it would be a lot quicker. Part of the reason it's taking time is because there isn't a market there. That has to be created artificially by the government. And it's not the technical challenges necessarily that are delaying things.
It is an economical challenge or an equity challenge, if you want, because you know, how do you reward a business to do that? And that creates a number of implications that we won't go in today because we don't have the time, of course. But you know, the key question is then who pays for the transportation and storage? And is that the consumer or is that the taxpayer or is it the company? You want to make to create a mechanism by which the emitters is not incentivized to shut down and move to another country, you know, because you want to keep the production here. But reduce the emissions. So there's a lot there that would be interesting to see what comes out also of COP26 in November in terms of carbon tax, carbon border tax, or economic modeling, because in the end it's economics that makes the world go round and engineers find a solution to make it work.
But it sounds like there's a whole new industry, CO2 waste disposal industry, that potentially could emerge. And from what you guys have talked about today, this is a multi-decade challenge and the scale is going to be huge. And it's the kind of thing that maybe investors would see as an annuity investment. You know, you can invest in something like this and you've got decades worth of income stream coming from this activity potentially. So that seems, you know, optimistic.
What I think is important, though, is that there's a big opportunity for the supply chain, you know, for the oil and gas supply chain, from engineering to, you know, service companies and et cetera. Because it's a different business, waste management or CO2 storage management, than it is producing oil and gas. But a lot of the engineering, construction, maintenance and operations has a similarity and a higher transferability. So from a job perspective and economic perspective is something that not only helps reducing the CO2 in the atmosphere, it also helps sustaining the local economy or the economy in the communities where that are based on oil and gas.
I was going to say that's absolutely right, Luca. And I think that's where the speed of progress comes back in again, because the faster the UK can get organized and get these things underway and get the experience and develop the equipment that you need, the bigger the export opportunity to other countries that are then following on behind.
All right.
Whereas if we delay, we won't be first and we won't be in that position.
Yeah. It's about developing that technology excellence and that IP that is exportable in addition to the experience.
Yeah.
I want to go back to the original question or the topic in a way, which is reusability or reuse an existing oil and gas infrastructure for that. I guess we cover some of the technical challenges there that somehow make a kind of a case-by-case answer, because of course if you can save the decommissioning cost of removing a pipeline and the installation cost of installing a new one by reusing one, it sounds logical and worth doing it. But you know, there are some implications. There's a society or a circular economy perspective in that. Why waste and something which is there if it can be reused? But there's also a timing element there, right? Because those pipelines are either in use or not in use. And the time they are in use or not in use might not be the same where you need them from CO2. So if a reservoir is still producing and you're ready to pump down CO2, you can't have the flow going both ways of the different fluid. And if instead you've abandoned already a field and you're not ready to put CO2 in there, maybe for the next 5-10 years, is a case of decommissioning versus mouthballing. And who pays, who supports the decommission liability? So there are other elements there that makes it more difficult to reuse. Are we going to say that it's probably better to just create a new infrastructure than reuse, or not really?
No, I don't think you can generalize. I think every project, every cluster is going to have to look at where it is they're capturing the CO2, where it is they're trying to get it to, and what infrastructure exists that is along that pathway, and what condition it is, and when it's going to be, whether it's decommissioned currently or in use, or when it's going to become available, what sort of condition it is. I mean, it's a project decision to look at these things, so it will have to be on a case by case basis. The only thing I would say is I think reuse of infrastructure for dense phase is more difficult than gas phase. So gas phase is a bigger opportunity, I think. I think the shorter the pipeline and the older the pipeline, the probably more difficult it is to make it work. Whereas the longer pipelines that are in really good condition, that's the real opportunity, isn't it? Because they are the ones that can be really expensive to install new.
Yeah. Well, as ever, time is our enemy, and we've got to the point where we're ready to wrap the conversation up. But it's been absolutely fascinating, quite a lot of technical detail, and quite a lot of really good discussion about the economics behind these projects as well. We haven't even got to some of the real technical issues that I'm obviously obsessed with, like how do you maintain and manage these pipeline systems with that are operating under CO2 conditions? Do you pick them the same? Do they have to be completely dry, et cetera? So we haven't even touched on that, but that's for another time perhaps. But if you had to leave the audience with one thought about this whole subject, just to close off, what would it be, guys? What would you say to sum up?
Well, I think I was listening to a climate scientist on a podcast a few days back, and he made a comment that to stop climate change, we need to stop climate change before we can stop using fossil fuels. That is almost certainly a given, and that means that CCUS has to be part of the picture moving forwards. The technologies that we have available to us are available now. We can do it now. There are a lot of technical challenges, but we just have to grasp that nettle and get on with it. In terms of building new infrastructure or using old infrastructure, there are challenges with both, cost challenges with new and maybe a transfer of ownership, maybe business model challenges with using infrastructure, but we have to do it. And we've got a resource of some of the best offshore subsea engineers available to us, who are desperately keen to work in this area. So we just need to get after it. We really need to get after CCUS, not ultimately as a way of allowing the oil and gas industry to keep going, but as a way of managing that transition between fossil fuel use and ultimately renewable use, because there's a mismatch in the energy demand there.
I guess I would leave you with one other thought, which is that we've focused on this podcast on CCUS and reuse of existing infrastructure, but that's not the only opportunity for reuse of infrastructure, of course. And there's a coming big developments of offshore wind and the potential possibly to transport that energy back to the UK with something other than electricity. It could be hydrogen or possibly ammonia. And I guess that also offers a big opportunity to reuse infrastructure. So the infrastructure that's out there is a big asset, and we need to look carefully at it with every opportunity to see if we can get the most out of it.
Look, a final thought from you?
I can't agree more with what Murray and Neil said. I would only add that it is a system challenge. To make it happen is a system of economic, fiscal, and support mechanism, in addition to the technical challenges. We need, I think, to start smart, learn quick, and innovate, and then scale faster. And in that sense, it is not only an opportunity to decarbonize industry, mainly through the use of CCS, it's also an opportunity to develop an economy in the UK that can then export skills, knowledge, IP, and technology. And that's a great opportunity to combine these two goals, I think.
That's a great way to finish off, guys. Thank you so much for your time this afternoon. Hope you enjoyed the conversation. I certainly have. I think there's a lot of food for thought in this particular episode of our series, and I'm sure we'll be returning to this topic sometime soon. But I wish you all the best at Crondall and working on these projects, and thank you, guys.
Thanks, Stephen. It was very, very enjoyable, and we appreciate the opportunity.
This podcast is brought to you by OGTC. We support the oil and gas industry to develop and deploy technology to accelerate the transition to an affordable net zero North Sea. We want to connect people, start discussions, and generate ideas to help provide solutions for our industry. So, listen, subscribe, and if you have any questions, get in touch with us via our website at ogtc.com. You can also follow us on our social media channels, LinkedIn, Twitter, and YouTube, for all our latest updates.